Recorded Books Incorporated presents an unabridged recording of The 11th Commandment by Jeffrey Archer, narrated by Paul Hecht. This work is copyrighted 1998 by Jeffrey Archer. This recording is copyrighted 1998 by Recorded Books Incorporated. Connor Fitzgerald is the professional's professional. Holder of the Medal of Honor, devoted family man, servant of his country, and the CIA's most deadly weapon. But for the last 28 years, Fitzgerald has been leading a double life. And only days from his retirement from the agency, he comes across an enemy even he cannot handle. And now, the 11th Commandment.
Book 1. The Team Player. Chapter 1. As he opened the door, the alarm went off. The sort of mistake you would expect an amateur to make, which was surprising, as Connor Fitzgerald was considered by his peers to be the professional's professional. Fitzgerald had anticipated that it would be several minutes before the local policia responded to a burglary in the San Victorino district. There were still a couple of hours to go before the kickoff of the annual match against Brazil, but half the television sets in Colombia would already be switched on. If Fitzgerald had broken into the pawn shop after the game had started, the policia probably wouldn't have followed it up until the referee had blown the final whistle. It was well known that the local criminals looked upon the match as a 90-minute parole period, but his plans for that 90 minutes would have the policia chasing their shadows for days. And it would be weeks, probably months, before anyone worked out the real significance of the break-in that Saturday afternoon. The alarm was still sounding as Fitzgerald closed the back door and made his way quickly through the small storeroom towards the front of the shop. He ignored the rows of watches on their little stands, emeralds in their cellophane bags, and gold objects of every size and shape displayed behind a fine mesh grill. All were carefully marked with a name and date, so their impoverished owners could return within 6 months and reclaim their family heirlooms. Few ever did. Fitzgerald swept aside the bead curtain that divided the storeroom from the shop and paused behind the counter. His eyes rested on a battered leather case on a stand in the center of the window. Printed on the lid in faded gold letters were the initials DVR. He remained absolutely still until he was certain that no one was looking in. When Fitzgerald had sold the handcrafted masterpiece to the shopkeeper earlier that day, he had explained that, as he had no intention of returning to Bogota, it could go on sale immediately. Fitzgerald was not surprised that the piece had already been placed in the window. There wouldn't be another one like it in Colombia. He was about to climb over the counter when a young man strolled past the window. Fitzgerald froze. But the man's attention was wholly occupied by a small radio he was pressing to his left ear. He took about as much notice of Fitzgerald as he would of a tailor's dummy. Once he was out of sight, Fitzgerald straddled the counter and walked to the window. He glanced up and down the road to check for any casual observers, but there were none. With one movement, he removed the leather case from its stand and walked quickly back. He leapt over the counter and turned to look out of the window again to reassure himself that no inquisitive eyes had witnessed the burglary. Fitzgerald swung round, pulled aside the bead curtain, and strode on towards the closed door. He checked his watch. The alarm had been blaring away for 98 seconds. He stepped into the alley and listened. Had he heard the whine of a police siren, he would have turned left and disappeared into the maze of streets that ran behind the pawnbroker's shop. But apart from the alarm, everything remained silent. He turned right and walked casually in the direction of Carrera Septima. When Connor Fitzgerald reached the pavement, he glanced left and then right, weaved through the light traffic, and without looking back, crossed to the far side of the street. He disappeared into a crowded restaurant where a group of noisy fans were seated around a large screen television. Nobody gave him a glance. Their only interest was in watching endless replays of the 3 goals Colombia had scored the previous year. He took a seat at a corner table. Although he couldn't see the television screen clearly, he had a perfect view across the street. A battered sign with the words J. Escobar, Monte de Piedad, Establecido 1946, flapped in the afternoon breeze above the pawn shop. Several minutes passed before a police car screeched to a halt outside the shop. Once Fitzgerald had seen the 2 uniformed officers enter the building, he left his table and walked nonchalantly out of the back door onto another quiet Saturday afternoon street. He hailed the first empty taxi and said in a broad South African accent, "El Belvedere on the Plaza de Bolivar, por favor." The driver nodded curtly, as if to make it clear that he had no wish to become involved in a prolonged conversation. As Fitzgerald slumped into the back of the battered yellow cab, he turned up the radio. Fitzgerald checked his watch again. 1:17. He was running a couple of minutes behind schedule. The speech would have already begun, but as they always lasted for well over 40 minutes, he still had more than enough time to carry out his real reason for being in Bogota. He moved a few inches to his right, so as to be sure the driver could see him clearly in the rearview mirror. Once the policía began their inquiries, Fitzgerald needed everyone who had seen him that day to give roughly the same description. Male, Caucasian, 50-ish, a shade over 6 foot, around 210 pounds, unshaven, dark, unruly hair, dressed like a foreigner with a foreign accent, but not American. He hoped that at least one of them would be able to identify the South African nasal twang. Fitzgerald had always been good at accents. In high school, he had regularly been in trouble for mimicking his teachers. The taxi's radio continued to pump out the views of expert after expert on the likely outcome of the annual fixture. Fitzgerald mentally switched off from a language he had little interest in mastering, although he had recently added falta, fuera, and gol to his limited vocabulary. When the little Fiat drew up outside the El Belvedere 17 minutes later, Fitzgerald handed over a 10,000 peso note and had slipped out of the cab before the driver had a chance to thank him for such a generous tip. Not that the taxi drivers of Bogota are well known for their overuse of the words muchas gracias. Fitzgerald ran up the hotel steps, past the liveried doorman, and through the revolving doors. In the foyer, he headed straight for the bank of elevators opposite the check-in desk. He had to wait only a few moments before one of the 4 lifts returned to the ground floor. When the doors slid open, he stepped inside and pressed the button marked 8 and the close button immediately afterwards, giving no one a chance to join him. When the doors opened on the 8th floor, Fitzgerald walked down the thinly carpeted corridor to room 807. He pushed a plastic card into the slot and waited for the green light to glow before he turned the handle. As soon as the door opened, he placed the Favor de no molestar sign on the outside knob, closed the door, and bolted it. He checked his watch yet again. 2:24. By now, he calculated that the police would have left the pawn shop having concluded that it was a false alarm. They would phone Mr. Escobar at his home in the country to inform him that everything appeared to be in order, and would suggest that when he returned to the city on Monday, he should let them know if anything was missing. But long before then, Fitzgerald would have replaced the battered leather case in the window. On Monday morning, the only items that Escobar would report stolen would be the several small packets of uncut emeralds that had been removed by the policía on their way out. How long would it be before he discovered the only other thing that was missing? A day? A week? A month? Fitzgerald had already decided he would have to leave the odd clue to help speed up the process. Fitzgerald took off his jacket, hung it over the nearest chair, and picked up the remote control from a table by the side of the bed. He pressed the on button and sat down on the sofa in front of the television. The face of Ricardo Guzman filled the screen. Fitzgerald knew that Guzman would be 50 next April, but at 6'1", with a full head of black hair and no weight problem, he could have told the adoring crowd that he had not yet turned 40, and they would have believed him. After all, few Colombians expected their politicians to tell the truth about anything, especially their age. Ricardo Guzman, the favorite in the upcoming presidential election, was the boss of the Cali cartel, which controlled 80% of the New York cocaine trade and made over $1 billion a year. Fitzgerald had not come across this information in any of Colombia's three national newspapers, perhaps because the supply of most of the country's newsprint was controlled by Guzman. "The first action I shall take as your president will be to nationalize any company in which Americans are the majority shareholders." The small crowd that surrounded the steps of the Congress building on the Plaza de Bolívar screamed their approval. Ricardo Guzman's advisers had told him again and again that it would be a waste of time making a speech on the day of the match. But he had ignored them, calculating that millions of television viewers would be flicking through the channels in search of the soccer and would come across him on their screens, if only for a moment. The same people would then be surprised only an hour later to see him striding into the packed stadium. Football bored Guzman, but he knew that his entrance moments before the home team were due to take the field would divert the crowd's attention away from Antonio Herrera, the Colombian vice president and his main rival in the election. Herrera would be seated in the VIP box, but Guzman would be in the midst of the crowd behind one of the goals. The image he wished to portray was of a man of the people. Fitzgerald estimated that there was about 6 minutes of the speech left. He had already heard Guzman's words at least a dozen times. In crowded halls, in half-empty bars, on street corners, even in a coach station while the candidate had addressed the local citizens from the back of a bus. He pulled the leather case off the bed and onto his lap. "Antonio Herrera is not the liberal candidate," hissed Guzman, "but the American candidate. He is nothing more than a ventriloquist's dummy, whose every word is chosen for him by the man who sits in the Oval Office." The crowd cheered again. 5 minutes, Fitzgerald calculated. He opened the case and stared down at the Remington 700 that had been out of his sight for only a few hours. "How dare the Americans assume that we will always fall in line with whatever is convenient for them," Guzman barked. "And simply because of the power of the God Almighty Dollar, to hell with the God Almighty Dollar." The crowd cheered even more loudly as the candidate took a dollar bill from his wallet and tore George Washington into shreds. "I can assure you of one thing," continued Guzman, scattering the tiny pieces of green paper over the crowd like confetti. "God isn't an American," mouthed Fitzgerald. "God isn't an American," shouted Guzman. Fitzgerald gently removed the Macmillan fiberglass stock from the leather case. "In 2 weeks' time, the citizens of Colombia will be given the opportunity to let their views be heard right across the world," Guzman shouted. 4 minutes, murmured Fitzgerald as he glanced up at the screen and mimicked the smile of the candidate. He took the heart stainless steel barrel from its resting place and screwed it firmly into the stock. It fitted like a glove. "Whenever summits are held around the world, Colombia will once again be sitting at the conference table, not reading about it in the press the following day. Within a year, I will have the Americans treating us not as a third world country, but as their equals." The crowd roared as Fitzgerald lifted the loopholed 10-power sniper scope from its place and slid it into the two little grooves on the top of the barrel. "Within 100 days, you will see changes in our country that Herrera wouldn't have believed possible in 100 years, because when I am your president..." Fitzgerald slowly nestled the stock of the Remington 700 into his shoulder. It felt like an old friend, but then it should have done. Every part had been handcrafted to his exact specifications. He raised the telescopic sight to the image on the television screen and lined up the little row of mill dots until they were centered an inch above the heart of the candidate. "Conquer inflation," 3 minutes. "Conquer unemployment," Fitzgerald breathed out and thereby conquer poverty. Fitzgerald counted 3, 2, 1, then gently squeezed the trigger. He could barely hear the click above the noise of the crowd. Fitzgerald lowered the rifle, rose from the sofa, and put the empty leather case down. It would be another 90 seconds before Guzman reached the ritual condemnation of President Lawrence. He removed one of the hollow-point bullets from its little leather slot inside the lid of the case. He broke the stock and slipped the bullet into its chamber, then snapped the barrel shut with a firm upward movement. "This will be a last chance for the citizens of Colombia to reverse the disastrous failures of the past," cried Guzman, his voice rising with every word. "So we must be sure of one thing." "1 minute," murmured Fitzgerald. He could repeat word for word the final 60 seconds of a Guzman speech. He turned his attention from the television and walked slowly across the room towards the French windows. "That we do not waste this golden opportunity." Fitzgerald pulled back the lace curtain that obscured the view of the outside world and stared across the Plaza de Bolívar to the north side of the square where the presidential candidate was standing on the top step of the Congress building, looking down on the crowd. He was about to deliver his coup de grace. Fitzgerald waited patiently. Never leave yourself in the open for longer than is necessary. "Viva la Colombia!" Guzman cried. "Viva la Colombia!" The mob screamed back in a frenzy, although many of them were no more than paid flunkies strategically placed among the crowd. "I love my country," declared the candidate. 30 seconds of the speech left. Fitzgerald pushed open the French windows to be greeted by the full volume of the masses repeating Guzman's every word. The candidate dropped his voice almost to a whisper. "And let me make one thing clear. My love of my country is my only reason for wishing to serve as your president." For a second time, Fitzgerald pulled the stock of the Remington 700 slowly up into his shoulder. Every eye was looking at the candidate as he boomed out the words, "Dios guarde a la Colombia." The noise became deafening as he raised both arms high in the air to acknowledge the roars of his supporters, shouting back, "Dios guarde a la Colombia." Guzman's hands remained triumphantly in the air for several seconds, as they did at the end of every speech, and, as always, for a few moments, he remained absolutely still. Fitzgerald lined up the tiny mil dots until they were an inch above the candidate's heart, and breathed out as he tightened the fingers of his left hand around the stock. 3, 2, 1, he murmured under his breath before gently squeezing the trigger. Guzman was still smiling as the boat-tailed bullet tore into his chest. A second later he slumped to the ground like a stringless puppet, fragments of bone, muscle, and tissue flying in every direction. Blood spurted over those who were standing nearest to him. The last Fitzgerald saw of the candidate was his outstretched arms, as if he was surrendering to an unknown enemy. Fitzgerald lowered the rifle, broke the stock, and quickly closed the French windows. His assignment was completed. His only problem now was to make sure he didn't break the 11th commandment. Chapter 2.
"Should I send a message of condolence to his wife and family?" asked Tom Lawrence.
No, Mr. President," replied the Secretary of State. "I think you should leave that to an Assistant Secretary for Inter-American Affairs. It now looks certain that Antonio Herrera will be the next president of Colombia, so he'll be the person you'll have to do business with."
"Will you represent me at the funeral, or should I send the vice president?"
"Neither of us would be my advice," replied the Secretary of State. "Our ambassador in Bogota can represent you quite adequately. As the funeral will take place this weekend, we couldn't be expected to be available at such short notice."
The president nodded. He had become accustomed to Larry Harrington's matter-of-fact approach to everything, including death. He could only wonder what line Larry would adopt were he himself to be assassinated.
If you have a moment, Mr. President, I think I should brief you in greater detail on our present policy in Colombia. The press may want to question you on the possible involvement of...
The president was about to interrupt him when there was a knock on the door, and Andy Lloyd entered the room. It must be 11 o'clock, thought Lawrence. He hadn't needed a watch since he had appointed Lloyd as his chief of staff.
Later, Larry, said the president. I'm about to give a press conference on the nuclear, biological, chemical, and conventional arms reduction bill, and I can't imagine many journalists will be interested in the death of a presidential candidate in a country that, let's face it, most Americans couldn't even place on a map.
Harrington said nothing. He didn't feel it was his responsibility to point out to the president that most Americans still couldn't place Vietnam on a map either. But once Andy Lloyd had entered the room, Harrington knew that only the declaration of a world war would have given him priority. He gave Lloyd a curt nod and left the Oval Office.
Why did I ever appoint that man in the first place? Lawrence asked, his eyes fixed on the closed door. Larry was able to deliver Texas, Mr. President, at a moment where our internal polls showed that the majority of Southerners considered you a northern wimp who would quite happily appoint a homosexual as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
I probably would, said Lawrence, if I thought he was the right man for the job. One of the reasons Tom Lawrence had offered his old college friend the post of White House Chief of Staff was that after 30 years they had no secrets from each other. Andy told it as he saw it, without any suggestion of guile or malice. This endearing quality ensured that he could never hope to be elected to anything himself, and would therefore never be a rival. The president flicked open the blue file marked Immediate that Andy had left for him earlier that morning. He suspected that his chief of staff had been up most of the night preparing it. He began to go over the questions Andy considered were the most likely to be asked at the midday press conference.
How much taxpayers' money do you anticipate saving by this measure?
I suppose Barbara Evans will be asking the first question, as usual, said Lawrence, looking up. Do we have any idea what it might be?
No, sir, Lloyd replied. But as she's been pressing for an arms reduction bill ever since the day you beat Gore in New Hampshire, she's hardly in a position to complain now that you're ready to deliver it.
True, but that won't necessarily stop her asking an unhelpful question.
Andy nodded his agreement as the president glanced at the next question.
How many Americans will lose their jobs as a result of this?
Lawrence looked up.
Is there anyone in particular you want me to avoid?
The rest of the bastards, said Lloyd with a grin. But when you wrap it up, go to Phil Ansanch.
Why Ansanch?
He backed the bill at every stage, and he's among your dinner guests tonight.
The president smiled and nodded as he continued to run his finger down the list of anticipated questions. He stopped at number 7.
Isn't this another example of America losing its way?
He looked up at his chief of staff.
Sometimes I think we're still living in the Wild West, the way certain members of Congress have reacted to this bill.
I agree, sir. But as you know, 40% of Americans still consider the Russians our greatest threat, and nearly 30% expect us to go to war with Russia in their lifetime.
Lawrence cursed and ran a hand through his thick, prematurely gray hair before returning to the list of questions, stopping again when he reached 19.
How much longer am I going to be asked questions about burning my draft card?
As long as you're the commander-in-chief, would be my guess, replied Andy.
The president mumbled something under his breath and moved on to the next question. He looked up again.
Surely there's no chance of Viktor Zarymsky becoming the next president of Russia.
Probably not, said Andy. But he's moved up to third place in the latest opinion poll, and although he's still well behind Prime Minister Chernopov and General Borodin, his stand against organized crime is beginning to make a dent in their leads. Probably because most Russians believe Chernopov is financed by the Russian mafia.
What about the general? He's been losing ground since most of the Russian army haven't been paid for months. The press have been reporting that soldiers are selling their uniforms to tourists on the streets.
Thank God the election's still a couple of years away. If it looked as if that fascist Zarymsky had the slightest chance of becoming the next president of Russia, an arms reduction bill wouldn't get past first base in either house.
Lloyd nodded as Lawrence turned the page. His finger continued to run down the questions. He stopped at 29.
How many members of Congress have weapons manufacturing and base facilities in their districts? He asked, looking back up at Lloyd.
72 senators and 211 House members, said Lloyd, without having to refer to his unopened file. You'll need to convince at least 60% of them to support you to guarantee a majority in both houses. And that's assuming we can count on Senator Bedell's vote.
Frank Bedell was demanding a comprehensive arms reduction bill when I was still in high school in Wisconsin, said the president. He has no choice but to support us.
He may still be in favor of the bill, but he feels you haven't gone far enough. He's just demanded that you reduce our defense expenditure by over 50%.
And how does he expect me to pull that off?
By withdrawing from NATO and allowing the Europeans to be responsible for their own defense?
But that's totally unrealistic, said Lawrence. Even the Americans for Democratic Action would come out against that. You know that? I know that. And I suspect that even the good senator knows that. But it doesn't stop him appearing on every television station from Boston to Los Angeles, claiming that a 50% reduction in defense expenditure would solve America's health care and pension problems overnight.
I wish Bedell spent as much time worrying about the defense of our people as he does about their health care, said Lawrence. How do I respond?
Lavish praise on him for his tireless and distinguished record of defending the interests of the elderly. But then go on to point out that as long as you are Commander-in-Chief, the United States will never lower its defenses. Your first priority will always be to ensure that America remains the most powerful nation on Earth, etc., etc. That way, we should keep Bedell's vote and perhaps even sway one or two of the hawks as well.
The president glanced at his watch before turning to the third page. He gave out a deep sigh when he came to question 31.
How can you hope to get this bill enacted when the Democrats don't have a majority in either house?
Okay, Andy, what's the answer to that one?
You explain that concerned Americans are making it clear to their elected representatives right across the country that this bill is long overdue and no more than common sense.
I used that line last time, Andy. For the drug enforcement bill, remember?
Yes, I do remember, Mr. President. And the American people backed you all the way.
Lawrence let out another deep sigh before saying, Oh, to govern a nation that doesn't have elections every 2 years and isn't hounded by a press corps convinced it could do a better job than the democratically elected government.
Even the Russians are having to come to terms with the phenomenon of the press corps, said Lloyd.
Who would have believed we'd live to see that?
Said Lawrence, as he scanned the final question.
My hunch is that if Chernopov promised the Russian voters that he intended to be the first president to spend more on health care than on defense, he'd romp home.
You may be right, said Lloyd, but you can also be certain that if Zarymsky were elected, he'd start rebuilding Russia's nuclear arsenal long before he considered building new hospitals.
That's for sure, said the president. But as there's no chance of that maniac being elected,
Andy Lloyd remained silent. Chapter 3. Fitzgerald knew that the next 20 minutes would decide his fate. He walked quickly across the room and glanced at the television. The crowd were fleeing from the square in every direction. Noisy elation had turned to blind panic. Two of Ricardo Guzman's advisers were bending over what remained of his body. Fitzgerald retrieved the spent cartridge and replaced it in its slot inside the leather case. Would the owner of the pawn shop notice that one of the bullets had been used? From the other side of the square, the unmistakable whine of a police siren rose above the noise of the screaming crowd. This time, the response had been a lot quicker. Fitzgerald unclipped the viewfinder and placed it in its sculpted slot. He then unscrewed the barrel, slipped it into position, and finally replaced the stock. He glanced at the television screen for the last time and watched the local policia pouring into the square. He grabbed the leather case, pocketed a book of matches from an ashtray on top of the television, then crossed the room and opened the door. He looked up and down the empty corridor, then walked quickly in the direction of the freight elevator. He jabbed the little white button on the wall several times. He had unlocked the window that led to the fire escape only moments before he left for the pawn shop, but he knew that if he had to fall back on his contingency plan, a posse of uniformed police would probably be waiting for him at the bottom of the rickety metal staircase. There would be no Rambo-type helicopter, blades whirring, offering him an escape to glory as bullets flew past his ears, hitting everything except him. This was the real world. When the heavy lift doors slid slowly open, Fitzgerald came face to face with a young waiter in a red jacket carrying an overloaded lunch tray. He had obviously drawn the short straw and not been given the afternoon off to watch the match. The waiter was unable to hide his surprise at the sight of a guest standing outside the freight elevator.
"No, señor, perdone, no puede entrar,"
he tried to explain as Fitzgerald brushed past him. But the guest had jabbed the button marked Planta Baja, and the doors had closed long before the young man could tell him that particular lift ended up in the kitchen. When he reached the ground floor, Fitzgerald moved deftly between the stainless steel tables covered with row upon row of hors d'oeuvres waiting to be ordered and bottles of champagne that would only be uncorked if the home side won. He had reached the far end of the kitchen, pushed his way through the swing doors, and disappeared out of sight long before any of the white-clad staff could think of protesting. He ran down a poorly lit corridor. He had removed most of the light bulbs from their sockets the previous night, to a heavy door that led to the hotel's underground car park. He removed a large key from his jacket pocket, closed the door behind him, and locked it. He headed straight for a small black Volkswagen parked in the darkest corner. He took a second, smaller key from his trouser pocket, unlocked the car's door, slipped behind the wheel, placed the leather case under the passenger seat, and turned on the ignition. The engine immediately sprang into life, even though it hadn't been used for the past 3 days. He revved the accelerator for a few seconds before easing the gear lever into first. Fitzgerald maneuvered the vehicle unhurriedly between the rows of parked cars and drove up the steep ramp out onto the street. He paused at the top of the slope. The policia were breaking into a parked car and didn't even glance in his direction. He turned left and headed slowly away from the Plaza de Bolívar. And then he heard the whining sound behind him. He glanced at the rearview mirror to see two policia outriders bearing down on him, their flashing lights full on. Fitzgerald pulled over to the side of the road as the outriders and the ambulance carrying Guzman's lifeless body sped past him. He took the next left down a side street and began a long, circuitous route to the pawn shop, often doubling back on himself. 24 minutes later, he drove into an alley and parked behind a truck. He retrieved the battered leather case from under the passenger seat and left the car unlocked. He planned to be back behind the wheel in less than 2 minutes. He quickly checked up and down the alley. There was no one in sight. Once again, as Fitzgerald entered the building, the alarm went off. But this time he was not worried about the speedy arrival of a passing patrol. Most of the policia would be fully occupied, either at the stadium, where the game was due to kick off in half an hour, or arresting anyone who was still within a mile of the Plaza de Bolívar. Fitzgerald closed the back door of the pawn shop behind him. For the second time that day, he moved quickly through the rear office and, sweeping back the bead curtains, stopped behind the counter. He checked for passers-by before returning the battered leather case to its original place in the window. When Escobar returned to the shop on Monday morning, how long would it be before he discovered that one of the 6 boat-tailed Magnum bullets had been fired and only the casing remained in place? And even then, would he bother to pass on the information to the police? Fitzgerald was back behind the wheel of the Volkswagen in less than 90 seconds. He could still hear the clanging alarm as he drove onto the main street and began to follow the signs for Aeropuerto Eldorado. No one showed the slightest interest in him. After all, the game was just about to kick off. In any case, what possible connection could there be between an alarm going off in a pawn shop in the San Victorino district and the assassination of a presidential candidate in the Plaza de Bolívar? Once Fitzgerald had reached the highway, he stuck to the center lane, never once exceeding the speed limit. Several police cars shot past him on their way into the city. Even if anyone had stopped him to check his papers, they would have found that everything was in order. The packed suitcase on the back seat would reveal nothing unusual for a businessman who was visiting Colombia to sell mining equipment. Fitzgerald slipped off the highway when he reached the exit for the airport. After a quarter of a mile, he suddenly swung right and drove into the parking lot of the San Sebastian Hotel. He opened the glove compartment and removed a much-stamped passport. With the book of matches he had taken from the El Belvedere, he set Dirk van Rensburg alight. When his fingers were about to be burnt, he opened the car door, dropped the remains of the passport on the ground, and stamped out the flames, making sure the South African crest was still recognizable. He put the matches on the passenger seat, grabbed his suitcase from the back, and slammed the door closed, leaving the keys in the ignition. He walked towards the front door of the hotel and deposited the remains of Dirk van Rensburg's passport and a large, heavy key in the litter bin at the bottom of the steps. Fitzgerald pushed through the revolving doors behind a group of Japanese businessmen and remained in their slipstream as they were ushered towards an open elevator. He was the only passenger to step out on the third floor. He headed straight for room 347, where he extracted another plastic card that unlocked another room, booked in another name. He tossed the suitcase onto the bed and checked his watch. 1 hour and 17 minutes until takeoff. He removed his jacket and threw it over the only chair, then opened the suitcase and took out a wash bag before disappearing into the bathroom. It was some time before the water was warm enough for him to place the plug in the basin. While he waited, he cut his nails. Then he scrubbed his hands as thoroughly as a surgeon preparing for an operation. It took Fitzgerald 20 minutes to remove every trace of his week-old beard, and several handfuls of shampoo needed to be rubbed in firmly under the warm shower before his hair returned to its natural wavy state and sandy color. Fitzgerald dried himself as best he could with a single thin towel the hotel had provided, then returned to the bedroom and put on a clean pair of jockey shorts. He walked over to the chest of drawers on the far side of the room, pulled open the third drawer, and felt about until he found the packet taped to the drawer above. Although he hadn't occupied the room for several days, he was confident that no one would have come across his hiding place. Fitzgerald ripped open the brown envelope and quickly checked its contents. Another passport and yet another name, $500 in used notes, and a first-class ticket to Cape Town. Escaping assassins don't travel first class. 5 minutes later, he left room 347, his old clothes strewn all over the floor, and a Favor de no molestar sign on the door. Fitzgerald took the guest elevator to the ground floor, confident that no one would give a 51-year-old man in a blue denim shirt, striped tie, sports jacket, and gray flannels a second look. He stepped out of the elevator and strolled across the lobby, making no attempt to check out. When he'd arrived 8 days earlier, he had paid cash in advance for the room. He had left the minibar locked and never once rung room service, made an outside call, or watched a pay film. There would be no extra charges on this guest's account. He only had to wait for a few minutes before the shuttle bus swept up to the entrance. He checked his watch. 43 minutes to take off. He wasn't at all anxious about missing Aeroperú's flight 63 to Lima. He felt sure nothing was going to run on time that day. Once the bus had dropped him at the airport, he made his way slowly in the direction of the check-in counter, where he wasn't surprised to be told that the flight to Lima had been held up by over an hour. Several policia in the overcrowded, chaotic departures hall were suspiciously eyeing every passenger, and although he was stopped and questioned several times and his case searched twice, he was eventually allowed to proceed to Gate 47. He slowed his pace when he saw a couple of backpackers being dragged off by airport security staff. He idly wondered just how many innocent, unshaven male Caucasians would spend the night being questioned in cells because of his actions earlier that afternoon. When Fitzgerald joined the queue that led to passport control, he repeated his new name under his breath. It was his third that day. The blue-uniformed official in the little cubicle flicked open the New Zealand passport and carefully studied the photograph inside, which bore an undeniable resemblance to the smartly dressed man standing in front of him. He handed back the passport and allowed Alistair Douglas, a civil engineer from Christchurch, to stroll through to the departure lounge. After further delay, the flight was finally called. A stewardess guided Mr. Douglas to a seat in the first-class section. "Would you care for a glass of champagne, sir?" Fitzgerald shook his head.
"No, thank you. A glass of still water will be just fine," he replied, trying out his New Zealand accent.
He fastened his seatbelt, sat back, and pretended to read the in-flight magazine as the aircraft began its slow progress down the bumpy runway. Because of the extended line of planes waiting to take off in front of them, there was enough time for Fitzgerald to choose the dishes he would eat and the movie he would watch long before the 727 began its acceleration for takeoff. When the wheels finally left the ground, Fitzgerald started to relax for the first time that day. Once the aircraft had reached its cruising altitude, he disposed of the in-flight magazine, closed his eyes, and began to think about what needed to be done once he landed in Cape Town.
"This is your captain speaking," said a somber voice. "I have an announcement to make which I know will cause some of you considerable distress."
Fitzgerald sat bolt upright. The one eventuality he hadn't planned for was an unscheduled return to Bogota.
"I am sorry to have to inform you that a national tragedy has taken place in Colombia today."
Fitzgerald lightly gripped the armrest of his seat and concentrated on breathing evenly. The captain hesitated for a moment.
"My friends," he declared gravely, "Colombia has suffered a terrible loss." He paused. "Our national team has been defeated by Brazil by 2-1.
An audible groan went through the cabin, as if crashing into the nearest mountain would have been a preferable alternative. Fitzgerald allowed the suggestion of a smile to cross his lips. The stewardess reappeared by his side. "Can I fix a drink for you now we're on our way, Mr. Douglas?"
"Thank you," Fitzgerald replied. "I think I'll have that glass of champagne after all."
Chapter 4. As Tom Lawrence entered the packed room, the press corps rose to their feet. "The President of the United States," declared the press secretary, just in case there was a visitor from outer space. Lawrence climbed the one step up to the podium and placed Andy Lloyd's blue file on the lectern. He waved at the assembled journalists in a now familiar gesture to let them know they could resume their seats.
"I am delighted to announce," began the president, sounding relaxed, "that I will be sending to Congress a bill which I promised the American people during the election campaign."
Few of the senior White House correspondents seated in front of him wrote down a word, as most of them knew that if there was going to be a story worth printing, it was much more likely to come during the question-and-answer session than from any prepared statement. In any case, the president's opening remarks would be handed to them in a press kit as they left the room. Old pros only fell back on the prepared text when they had to fill extra column inches. This did not stop the president from reminding them that the passing of an arms reduction bill would allow him to release more revenue for long-term health care so that elderly Americans could expect a better standard of living during their retirement.
"This is a bill that will be welcomed by any decent, caring citizen, and I am proud to be the president who will guide it through Congress."
Lawrence looked up and smiled hopefully, feeling satisfied that his opening statement, at least, had gone well. Shouts of "Mr. President" came from every direction as Lawrence opened his blue file and glanced down at the 31 likely questions. He looked up and smiled at a familiar face in the front row.
"Barbara,"
he said, pointing to the veteran UPI journalist, whose right it was as the doyen of the press corps to ask the first question. Barbara Evans rose slowly to her feet.
Thank you, Mr. President.
She paused for a moment before asking, Are you able to confirm that the CIA had no involvement in the assassination of the Colombian presidential candidate Ricardo Guzman in Bogota on Saturday? A buzz of interest rippled around the room. Lawrence stared down at the redundant 31 questions and answers, wishing he hadn't dismissed Larry Harrington's offer of a more detailed briefing quite so casually.
I'm glad you asked that question, Barbara, he responded without missing a beat, because I want you to know that while I'm president, such a suggestion doesn't even arise. This administration would never, in any circumstances, interfere with the democratic process of a sovereign state. In fact, only this morning I instructed the Secretary of State to call Mr. Guzman's widow and pass on my personal condolences. Lawrence was relieved that Barbara Evans had mentioned the dead man's name, because otherwise he wouldn't have been able to recall it. It may also be of interest to you to know, Barbara, that I've already asked the Vice President to represent me at the funeral, which I understand will be held in Bogota this weekend. Pete Dowd, the Secret Service agent in charge of the Presidential Protective Division, immediately left the room to warn the Vice President before the press got to him. Barbara Evans looked unconvinced, but before she could follow up with a second question, the President had turned his attention to a man standing in the back row, who he hoped would have no interest in the presidential election in Colombia. But once he had asked his question, Lawrence began to wish he had. What chance does your arms reduction bill have of becoming law if Viktor Zarymsky looks likely to be the next Russian president?
For the next 40 minutes, Lawrence answered several questions about the nuclear, biological, chemical, and conventional arms reduction bill, but they were interspersed with demands to be told about the CIA's current role in South America and how he would deal with Viktor Zarymsky should he become the next Russian president. As it became all too apparent that Lawrence didn't know a great deal more than they did about either subject, the hacks, scenting blood, began to badger him on them to the exclusion of all others, including the arms reduction bill. When Lawrence at last received a sympathetic question from Phil Ansanch on the subject of the bill, he gave a long, discursive reply, and then, without warning, wrapped up the press conference by smiling down at the baying journalists and saying, Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. It's been a pleasure, as always. Without another word, he turned his back on them, quickly left the room, and headed in the direction of the Oval Office. The moment Andy Lloyd had caught up with him, the President growled under his breath, I need to speak to Larry Harrington immediately. As soon as you've tracked him down, call Langley. I want the director of the CIA in my office within the hour.
I wonder, Mr. President, if it might be wiser, began the Chief of Staff.
Within the hour, Andy, said the President, not even looking at him. If I find out that the CIA had any involvement in that assassination in Colombia, I'll hang Dexter out to dry.
I'll ask the Secretary of State to join you immediately, Mr. President, said Lloyd. He disappeared into a side office, picked up the nearest phone, and dialed Larry Harrington at the State Department. Even over the phone, the Texan was unable to disguise his pleasure at being proved right so quickly. When Lloyd had put the phone down, he made his way back to his own office, closed the door, and sat silently at his desk for a few moments. Once he had thought through exactly what he needed to say, he dialed a number that only one person ever answered. The director, was all Helen Dexter said. Connor Fitzgerald handed over his passport to the Australian customs official. It would have been ironic if the document had been challenged because, for the first time in 3 weeks, he was using his real name. The uniformed officer tapped out the details on his keyboard, checked the computer screen, then pressed a few more keys. Nothing untoward appeared, so he stamped the tourist visa and said, "Hope you enjoy your visit to Australia, Mr. Fitzgerald." Connor thanked him and walked through to the baggage hall, where he took a seat opposite the motionless consul and waited for his luggage to appear. He never allowed himself to be the first to pass through customs, even when he had nothing to declare. When he had landed in Cape Town the previous day, Connor had been met off the plane by his old friend and colleague, Carl Coter. Carl had spent the next couple of hours debriefing him before they enjoyed a long lunch discussing Carl's divorce and what Maggie and Tara were up to. It was the second bottle of 1982 Rustenburg Cabernet Sauvignon that nearly caused Connor to miss his flight to Sydney. In the duty-free shop, he hurriedly chose presents for his wife and daughter that were clearly stamped made in South Africa. Even his passport gave no clue that he had arrived in Cape Town via Bogota, Lima, and Buenos Aires. As he sat in the baggage collection zone waiting for the consul to start up, he began to think about the life he had been leading for the past 28 years. Connor Fitzgerald had been brought up in a family dedicated to the cause of law and order. His paternal grandfather, Oscar, named after another Irish poet, had emigrated to America from Kilkenny at the turn of the century. Within hours of landing at Ellis Island, he had headed straight for Chicago to join his cousin in the police department. During Prohibition, Oscar Fitzgerald was among the small band of cops who refused to take bribes from the mob. As a result, he failed to rise above the rank of sergeant. But Oscar did sire five God-fearing sons, and only gave up when the local priest told him it was the Almighty's will that he and Mary wouldn't be blessed with a daughter. His wife was grateful for Father O'Reilly's words of wisdom. It was difficult enough raising five strapping lads on a sergeant's salary. Mind you, if Oscar had ever given her 1 cent more than she was entitled to from his weekly pay packet, Mary would have wanted to know in great detail where it came from. On leaving high school, three of Oscar's boys joined the Chicago PD, where they quickly gained the promotion their father had deserved. Another took holy orders, which pleased Mary, and the youngest, Connor's father, studied criminal justice at DePaul on the GI Bill. After graduating, he joined the FBI. In 1949, he married Catherine O'Keefe, a girl who lived two doors away on South Low Street. They only had one child, a son, whom they christened Connor. Connor was born in Chicago General Hospital on the 8th of February, 1951, and even before he was old enough to attend the local Catholic school, it had become clear that he was going to be a gifted football player. Connor's father was delighted when his son became captain of the Mount Carmel High School team, but his mother still kept him working late into the night to make sure he always completed his homework. "You can't play football for the rest of your life," she continually reminded him. The combination of a father who stood whenever a woman entered the room and a mother who verged on being a saint had left Connor, despite his physical prowess, shy in the presence of the opposite sex. Several girls at Mount Carmel High had made it only too obvious how they felt about him. But he didn't lose his virginity until he met Nancy in his senior year. Shortly after he had led Mount Carmel to another victory one autumn afternoon, Nancy had taken him behind the bleachers and seduced him. It would have been the first time he'd ever seen a naked woman, if she'd taken off all her clothes. About a month later, Nancy asked him if he'd like to try two girls at once. "I haven't even had two girls, let alone at once," he told her. Nancy didn't seem impressed and moved on. When Connor won a scholarship to Notre Dame, he didn't take up any of the numerous offers that came the way of all the members of the football team. His teammates seemed to take great pride in scratching the names of the girls who had succumbed to their charms on the inside of their locker doors. Brett Coleman, the team's place kicker, had 17 names inside his locker by the end of the first semester. The rule, he informed Connor, was that only penetration counted. The locker doors just aren't big enough to include oral sex. At the end of his first year, Nancy was still the only name Connor had scratched up. After practice one evening, he checked through the other lockers and discovered that Nancy's name appeared on almost every one of them, occasionally bracketed with that of another girl. The rest of the team would have given him hell for his low scoring if he hadn't been the best freshman quarterback Notre Dame had seen for a decade. It was during Connor's first few days as a sophomore that everything changed. When he turned up for his weekly session at the Irish Dance Club, she was putting on her shoes. He couldn't see her face, but that didn't matter much because he was unable to take his eyes off those long, slim legs.
As a football hero, he had become used to girls staring at him, but now the one girl he wanted to impress didn't seem aware that he even existed. To make matters worse, when she stepped onto the dance floor, she was partnered by Declan O'Casey, who had no rival as a dancer. They both held their backs rigidly straight, and their feet moved with a lightness Connor could never hope to match. When the number came to an end, Connor still hadn't discovered her name, and worse, she and Declan had left before he could find some way of being introduced to her. In desperation, he decided to follow them back to the women's dorms, walking 50 yards behind and always remaining in the shadows, just as his father had taught him. He grimaced as they held hands and chatted happily. When they reached Lamont's hall, she kissed Declan on the cheek and disappeared inside. Why, he wondered, hadn't he concentrated more on dancing and less on football? After Declan had headed off in the direction of the men's dorms, Connor began to stroll casually up and down the sidewalk below the dormitory windows, wondering if there was anything he could do. He finally caught a glimpse of her in a dressing gown as she drew the curtain, and hung around for a few more minutes before reluctantly returning to his room. He sat on the end of his bed and began composing a letter to his mother, telling her that he had seen the girl he was going to marry, although he hadn't actually spoken to her yet. And come to think of it, he didn't even know her name. As Connor licked the envelope, he tried to convince himself that Declan O'Casey was nothing more to her than a dancing partner. During the week, he tried to find out as much as he could about her, but he picked up very little other than that she was called Maggie Burke, had won a scholarship to St. Mary's, and was in her freshman year studying art history. He cursed the fact that he had never entered an art gallery in his life. In fact, the nearest he'd come to painting was whenever his father asked him to touch up the fence surrounding their little backyard on South Low Street. Declan, it turned out, had been dating Maggie since her last year at school and was not only the best dancer in the club, but was also considered the university's brightest mathematician. Other institutions were already offering him fellowships to pursue a postgraduate degree even before the results of his final exams were known. Connor could only hope that Declan would be offered an irresistible post far away from South Bend as soon as possible. Connor was the first to turn up at the dance club the following Thursday, and when Maggie appeared from the changing room in her cream cotton blouse and short black skirt, the only question he had to consider was whether to stare up into those green eyes or down at her long legs. Once again, she was partnered by Declan all evening, while Connor sat mutely on a bench, trying to pretend he wasn't aware of her presence. After the final number, the two of them slipped off. Once again, Connor followed them back to Lamont's hall, but this time he noticed that she wasn't holding Declan's hand. After a long chat and another kiss on the cheek, Declan disappeared off in the direction of the men's dorms. Connor slumped down on a bench opposite her window and stared up at the balcony of the girls' dormitory. He decided to wait until he had seen her draw the curtains, but by the time she appeared at the window, he dozed off. The next thing he remembered was waking from a deep sleep, in which he had been dreaming that Maggie was standing in front of him dressed in pajamas and a dressing gown. He woke with a start, stared at her in disbelief, jumped up and thrust out his hand. "Hi, I'm Connor Fitzgerald." "I know," she replied as she shook his hand. "I'm Maggie Burke." "I know," he said. "Any room on that bench?" she asked. From that moment, Connor never looked at another woman. On the following Saturday, Maggie went to a football game for the first time in her life and watched him pull off a series of remarkable plays in front of what was for him a packed stadium of one. The next Thursday, she and Connor danced together all evening while Declan sat disconsolately in a corner. He looked even more desolate when the two of them left together holding hands. When they reached Lamont's hall, Connor kissed her for the first time, then fell on one knee and proposed. Maggie laughed, turned bright red, and ran inside. On his way back to the men's dorms, Connor also laughed, but only when he spotted Declan hiding behind a tree. From then on, Connor and Maggie spent every moment of their spare time together. She learned about touchdowns, end zones, and lateral passes, he about Bellini, Bernini, and Luini. Every Thursday evening for the next 3 years, he fell on one knee and proposed to her. Whenever his teammates asked him why he hadn't scratched her name on the inside of his locker, he replied simply, "Because I'm going to marry her." At the end of Connor's final year, Maggie finally agreed to be his wife, but not until she had completed her exams. "It's taken me 141 proposals to make you see the light," he said triumphantly. "Oh, don't be stupid, Connor Fitzgerald," she told him. "I knew I was going to spend the rest of my life with you the moment I joined you on that bench." They were married 2 weeks after Maggie had graduated summa cum laude. Tara was born 10 months later. Chapter 5. "Do you expect me to believe that the CIA didn't even know that an assassination attempt was being considered?"
"That is correct, sir," said the director of the CIA calmly. "The moment we became aware of the assassination, which was within seconds of it taking place, I contacted the National Security Advisor, who, I understand, reported directly to you at Camp David."
The president began to pace around the Oval Office, which he found not only gave him more time to think, but usually made his guests feel uneasy. Most people who entered the Oval Office were nervous already. His secretary had once told him that 4 out of 5 visitors went to the restroom only moments before they were due to meet the president. But he doubted if the woman sitting in front of him even knew where the nearest restroom was. If a bomb had gone off in the Rose Garden, Helen Dexter would probably have done no more than raise a well-groomed eyebrow. Her career had outlasted 3 presidents so far, all of whom were rumored at some point to have demanded her resignation. "And when Mr. Lloyd phoned to tell me that you required more details," said Dexter, "I instructed my deputy, Nick Guttenberg, to contact our people on the ground in Bogota and to make extensive inquiries as to exactly what happened on Saturday afternoon. Guttenberg completed his report yesterday." She tapped the file on her lap. Lawrence stopped pacing and came to a halt under a portrait of Abraham Lincoln that hung above the fireplace. He looked down at the nape of Helen Dexter's neck. She continued to face straight ahead. The director was dressed in an elegant, well-cut dark suit with a simple cream shirt. She rarely wore jewelry, even on state occasions. Her appointment by President Ford as deputy director at the age of 32 was meant to have been a stopgap to placate the feminist lobby a few weeks before the 1976 election. As it was, Ford turned out to be the stopgap. After a series of short-term directors who either resigned or retired, Ms. Dexter finally ended up with a coveted position. Many rumors circulated in the hothouse atmosphere of Washington about her extreme right-wing views and the methods she had used to gain promotion. But no member of the Senate dared to question her appointment. She had graduated summa cum laude from Bryn Mawr, followed by the University of Pennsylvania Law School, before joining one of New York's leading law firms. After a series of rows with the board over the length of time it took women to become partners, ending in litigation that was settled out of court, she had accepted an offer to join the CIA. She began her life with the agency in the office of the Directorate of Operations, eventually rising to become its deputy. By the time of her appointment, she had made more enemies than friends. But as the years passed, they seemed to disappear, or were fired, or took early retirement. When she was appointed director, she had just turned 40. The Washington Post described her as having blasted a hole through the glass ceiling, but that didn't stop the bookies offering odds on how many days she would survive. Soon they altered that to weeks, and then months. Now they were taking bets on whether she would last longer as the head of the CIA than J. Edgar Hoover had at the FBI. Within days of Tom Lawrence taking up residence in the White House, he had discovered the lengths to which Dexter would go to block him if he tried to encroach on her world. If he asked for reports on sensitive subjects, it was often weeks before they appeared on his desk. And when they eventually did, they inevitably turned out to be long, discursive, boring, and already out of date. If he called her into the Oval Office to explain unanswered questions, she could make a deaf mute appear positively forthcoming. If he pushed her, she would play for time, obviously assuming she would still be in her job long after the voters had turned him out of his. But it was not until he proposed his nomination for a vacancy on the Supreme Court that he saw Helen Dexter at her most lethal. Within days, she had placed files on his desk that went to great lengths to point out why the nominee was unacceptable. Lawrence had pressed on with the claims of his candidate, one of his oldest friends who was found hanging in his garage the day before he was due to take up office. He later discovered that the confidential file had been sent to every member of the Senate Selection Committee, but he was never able to prove who had been responsible. Andy Lloyd had warned him on several occasions that if he ever tried to remove Dexter from her post, he had better have the sort of proof that would convince the public that Mother Teresa had held a secret bank account in Switzerland regularly topped up by organized crime syndicates. Lawrence had accepted his chief of staff's judgment, but he now felt that if he could prove the CIA had been involved in the assassination of Ricardo Guzman without even bothering to inform him, he could have Dexter clearing her desk within days. He returned to his chair and touched the button under the rim of his desk, which would allow Andy to listen in on the conversation or pick it up off the tape later that evening. Lawrence realized that Dexter would know exactly what he was up to, and he suspected that the legendary handbag, which never left her side, lacked the lipstick, perfume, and compact usually associated with her sex, and had already recorded every syllable that had passed between them. Nevertheless, he still needed his version of events for the record.
"As you seem to be so well informed," the president said as he sat down, "perhaps you could brief me in more detail on what actually happened in Bogota."
Helen Dexter ignored his sarcastic tone and picked up a file from her lap. The white cover bearing a CIA logo had printed across it the words, "For the President's Eyes Only." Lawrence wondered just how many files she had stashed away across the river marked "For the Director's Eyes Only." She flicked the file open. "It has been confirmed by several sources that the assassination was carried out by a lone gunman," she read. "Name one of these sources," snapped the president. "Our cultural attaché in Bogotá," replied the director. Lawrence raised an eyebrow. Half the cultural attachés in American embassies around the world had been placed there by the CIA simply to report back directly to Helen Dexter at Langley without any consultation with the local ambassador, let alone the State Department. Most of them would have thought the Nutcracker Suite was a dish to be found on the menu of an exclusive restaurant. The president sighed. "And who does he think was responsible for the assassination?" Dexter flicked over a few pages of the file, extracted a photograph, and pushed it across the Oval Office desk. The president looked down at a picture of a well-dressed, prosperous-looking, middle-aged man.
"And who's this?"
"Carlos Velez. He runs the second-largest drug cartel in Colombia. Guzman, of course, controlled the biggest."
"And has Velez been charged?"
"Unfortunately, he was killed only a few hours after the police had obtained a warrant to arrest him."
"How convenient."
The director didn't blush. Not possible in her case, thought Lawrence. After all, blushing requires blood.
And did this lone assassin have a name, or did he also die only moments after a court order was...
"No, sir. He's still very much alive," the director replied firmly. "His name is Dirk Van Rensburg."
"What's known about him?" asked Lawrence.
"He's South African. Until recently, he lived in Durban."
"Until recently?"
"Yes, he went underground immediately after the assassination."
"That would be quite easy to do if you were never above ground in the first place," said the president.
He waited for the director to react, but she remained impassive. Eventually, he said,
"Do the Colombian authorities go along with your account of what happened, or is our cultural attaché your only source of information?"
"No, Mr. President. We picked up the bulk of our intelligence from Bogota's chief of police. In fact, he already has in custody one of Van Rensburg's accomplices, who was employed as a waiter at the El Belvedere Hotel, the building from which the shot was fired. He was arrested in the corridor only moments after he had helped the assassin to escape in the freight elevator."
"And do we know anything of Van Rensburg's movements following the assassination?"
he seems to have taken a flight to Lima in the name of Alastair Douglas, and then continued on to Buenos Aires using the same passport. We lost track of him after that.
And I doubt if you'll ever find him again.
Oh, I wouldn't be that pessimistic, Mr. President, said Dexter, ignoring Lawrence's tone. Hired assassins tend to be loners who often disappear for several months following a job of this importance. Then they reappear once they feel the heat is off.
Well, said the President, let me assure you that in this case I intend to keep the heat on. When we next meet, I may well have a report of my own for you to consider.
I shall look forward to reading it, said Dexter, sounding like the school bully who had no fear of the headmaster.
The President pressed a button under his desk. A moment later there was a tap on the door, and Andy Lloyd entered the room.
Mr. President, you have a meeting with Senator Bedell in a few minutes, he said, ignoring Dexter's presence.
Then I'll leave you, Mr. President, said Dexter, rising from her place. She put the file on the President's desk, picked up her handbag, and left the room without another word.
The President didn't speak until the director of the CIA had closed the door behind her. Then he turned to his chief of staff.
I don't believe a word of it, he muttered as he dropped the file into the out tray.
Lloyd made a mental note to retrieve it as soon as his boss had left the room.
I guess the best we can hope for is that we've put the fear of God in her and that she won't consider carrying out another operation like that while